Time now for hour number two of this weekend's two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And here again is Carol Marks, the host of the program, kicking off this hour with a conversation that was recorded in Washington, D.C. at the recent Families USA conference, talking about health care with Ron Pollack, the head of Families USA.
And, of course, there's been a little bit of trouble, you know, rolling it out in the beginning with the software. I guess they have the front end fixed, and they're working on the back end. Is that right? How does it, what are the reports that you're getting, you know, about it getting fixed and being better, easier for people to access?
Well, in the beginning, it really was not functioning well. October and parts of November, it wasn't functioning that well. But now it's functioning a whole lot better, and people really are not having any significant problems. So I think now the road is clear. We can get people enrolled. People can get the information they need. So things have really turned around.
And that's terrific. It's so important. And now there's a mental health priority and Addiction Equity Act that's involved in all of this. And that's so important because people that have chronic health problems and have acute problems often get depressed and have other problems as a result.
That's right. And, you know, mental health problems should get as much attention as physical health problems. And the Affordable Care Act does that. It includes mental health coverage, which often has not existed in the past, but now it will be provided as a mandatory benefit. And that's going to be very good because people with mental health problems have often been shunted aside. It's like mental health is treated as if it's totally different than physical health. You got to take care of both of those things, and the Affordable Care Act makes sure that happens.
And there are kind of two parts. There's a part, the federal part, and then there's a part with the states, with the exchanges. And do people realize, you know, the exchanges are different in the states, and they have, some of them have gotten waivers, and so they really need to look into their particular state and see what's being offered.
Yeah, in every state, you have somewhat difference in terms of what kind of health plans are available and what the prices are, the premiums. You can't say that what exists in Connecticut is what exists in Colorado or in Wyoming. This is really localized, and people need to get the information about what kinds of plans are available in their area, what the costs are, what kind of benefits, what kind of deductibles and copays. But I think as people do that, they're going to find out it is a much better day. The one thing I really want to emphasize, the thing that probably is most significant that too few people know about, is that people can get significant subsidies to help pay for their premiums. And these subsidies reach deeply into the middle class. If you're living alone, you're eligible for the subsidies if your income is below $46,000 a year. If you're part of a family of four, it goes all the way up to $94,200. And these subsidies are in the thousands of dollars, so it reduces people's out-of-pocket costs for premiums. That's a big deal.
And that's so important. And as you say, a lot of people don't know that. What else do you think that people don't know about the Affordable Care Act that you think is important to emphasize?
Well, in addition to the help people can get with premiums, those people with moderate incomes also have some protections with respect to costs like deductibles and copayments. And so this is really important because the biggest problem with respect to health coverage is affordability. And there are key ways that people can get help. Now, for the lowest income folks, there is a Medicaid expansion. So far, half the states in the country, 25 states plus the District of Columbia, have decided to do this Medicaid expansion. I think soon we'll have other states also join in that process.
Because it's so cost effective. I mean, I don't think it makes any sense for them not to do it.
For any state that approves this, 100% of the funding in the first 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, is paid by the federal government. Then it goes down a bit, but it never goes below 90%. And so this is a great deal for the states to get this federal money so that people in the state who are uninsured can get coverage. And by the way, not only does it help the people who are uninsured, but with this big influx of money going into the states, it means that there'll be many more jobs in the state, which is going to help each state's economy.
Absolutely. And some of the jobs are going to be in health care.
That's right. That's right. Obviously, with this money going in to extend coverage, the first key jobs will be in the healthcare sector. But, you know, when people in the healthcare sector get hired and have extra income that they haven't had before, they wind up being consumers. They purchase automobiles or refrigerators or other consumer goods. And so it has a multiplier effect throughout the state's economy.
And you would say, because, you know, you see, and this I don't understand, I'll see a column that says that the enrollment in for the Affordable Care Act is great and it's growing, and then you'll see another article that says it's not, and that really confuses people.
Well, sure. But we've only gotten through about the first half of the first enrollment period. I think we're going to see many, many millions of people get enrolled. Some of them are going to get enrolled in private insurance, with most of them getting these subsidies that will make insurance premiums much more affordable. But we're also going to see a lot of people get coverage through the Medicaid program, especially in these 25 states that have already opted into this Medicaid expansion. By the end of this enrollment period, which ends on March 31, I think we're going to have a huge number of many, many millions of people who will gain coverage.
You know, that's what America is all about, the right to be healthy, to have health care. So many other countries have it. So I'm glad to see that finally we are making progress in the right direction. But it has taken us, you know, so long to get here. And were there any time in all the years you've been working at this where you said, I don't know, is this going to happen? Or did you always have that spirit, it's going to be?
Well, look, this has truly taken decades. Numerous presidents, you know. Teddy Roosevelt wanted this. Franklin Roosevelt wanted it. Harry Truman wanted this. Lyndon Johnson wanted it. Richard Nixon even had a significant proposal. Bill Clinton. So we didn't succeed all that quickly, but ultimately this is so important for families across America. We finally brought it over the finish line. And, you know, one of the things I like to say is there's no such thing as a permanent victory or a permanent defeat. And so we still have some work to do.
Now we got to say those areas are that we need to work on, because, you know, our listeners can help if they're informed and they know what still we need to put pressure on and get it done.
So the most important thing is we got to get people enrolled. You know, that starts by helping to inform people about how the Affordable Care Act can affect their lives. And as people learn that, they're going to get enrolled. You know, we have so many people who have already gotten enrolled who are telling their own stories about how they got help. Particularly, they got subsidy help that made the cost of getting insurance much more affordable. And as people learn those stories and they hear people talk about it who are very much like them, I think we're going to see a lot more people become aware about how the Affordable Care Act can help them, and they'll get enrolled.
And anything that you think people can really be helpful and work on that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think it's first very important that people learn about what the Affordable Care Act provides. And if you go to our website is www.familiesusa.org, familiesusa.org. We've got lots of publications about the Affordable Care Act. You can download them for free. And as people learn that, then they could share this information with their neighbors, their friends, and family members.
And that's important. And actually, America, I always think, is a family, a big family, a diverse family. And we can work together and get things done. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing. Anything else that Families USA is working on beside the Affordable Care Act that you have, that you'd like to mention?
Well, I'll mention one other thing that is part of the Affordable Care Act. We are working hard and with colleagues in states across the country to make sure that the states that have not yet opted into the Medicaid expansion do so. But the work that we have in front of us is that we've got to do much more to create value in health care coverage. That means making sure that costs are not too high and that people get really good care. And that's going to be the key next job. And we've got a ways to go on that, but I think we'll get there.
And are you all concerned about two entities that they have cooperated, but they can be difficult? We know that from the past, the insurance companies and sometimes the hospitals.
Well, with insurance companies, it makes sense for them to cooperate with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act because, you know, it actually gets them more clients. Now, and the hospitals have been really supportive of expanding coverage because if you don't have expanded coverage, they have people going to emergency rooms who can't pay for the cost of the services. A hospital either eats that or passes it along to other people. So they have been supporters. Now, on the question of getting costs down, well, that's going to be a different context because obviously, to get costs down means that some who make their money off the healthcare system will feel, well, wait a minute, am I going to be in a different situation where I'm not getting as much revenue? So we will have to work with groups that are key providers in the healthcare system so we can find good ways to provide value and high-quality coverage.
And when it comes to premiums, will people who earn, you know, a great deal, you know, be paying, you know, higher premiums, trying to make the system, you know, fairer for those who can do it?
Well, with each passing year, premiums have risen substantially for, you know, the last two decades. I think that the Affordable Care Act will decelerate those costs.
Of course.
And so I think we'll see some benefit there as well.
Excellent. And you must feel, hey, we really did something, and you know, everybody said it couldn't be done?
Well, it could be done. It was done. Now we got to make it real so it's a living reality for
absolutely
people across the country.
And, you know, you and I are going to keep our eyes out and see what insidious rules and regulations could come down from some things like Medicare and Medicaid and let people know, because, it's, you know, you've always got to be careful. And people and organizations try to mess things up, but we're not going to let them.
No, we're not. We're not going back. You know, as Vice President Biden made clear, we've made significant headway, and we're not turning back.
Well, you're a hero, and I look forward to having you back on A Touch of Gray.
It's so great to see you again.
Thank you.
That's Ron Pollack, the executive director of the nonprofit organizations Family USA, speaking with Carol Marks at their recent Health Meeting Action 2014 in Washington, D.C. Carol Marks returns with more conversation when A Touch of Gray continues.
More than 1 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE, or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation with Iris Krasnow. She's a New York Times bestselling author, journalist, professor, and professional speaker, and is going to talk about her new book titled Sex After: Women Share How Intimacy Changes as Life Changes published by Gotham Books.
As we've gone through so many sexual changes in the past three decades, it's very helpful to have a book that shows how they have affected the women who've lived through them. I am an older woman, so I have to ask, what most surprised you about what the women you interviewed who are older had to say about sex? What did they tell you?
Well, I loved, you know, right now I'm in Miami and I'm about to speak to, you know, I'm doing a book event in Miami, and I'm just hoping that there's many silver foxes in my audience. You know, I'm 59 years old. The women who are 85 and 78 and 90, they just inspired me so much. I mean, you know, people think about sex till the day they die. And it's not sex, you know, in the back seat of your car. But I believe the sexual adventures and, you know, successes and the true depth of intimacy is achieved much more for women over the age of 65 than those 20-year-olds that are struggling. So the surprise for me was, you know, I mean, I say this lovingly, very lovingly, you know, the hot grannies, the women who were in the, you know, still fitness addicts, they were golfing, they were playing tennis. Maybe they were new widows who had had a sick spouse for 15 years and they're dating again at 81. So I think the surprise and the hope and that tunnel that people go through as they age, I just want to say there is light at the end of the tunnel. If you're open, you know, with an open mind, anything is possible. You know, many women I interviewed in their middle 70s who were dating again, I thought were having more robust, satisfied, fulfilling, even sexy intimate lives than some of those young women struggling in their 20s, and certainly more, you know, when you have a baby and you have a new marriage. I mean, that's no fun. So
no,
these women were free.
You bring good news. You bring good news.
I think I'm the bearer of good news on this one.
And I do too.
You know, the buzz I'm getting most of all is that, and you know this, so I'll just share this. You know, again, I'm 59. I have four sons in their 20s, and I'm a college professor at American University. And many young people, if they think about old people having sex, there's two responses. One is yuck, and the other is, wow, that's great. I've got a lot to look forward to. So I want to eliminate the yuck factor. You know, I mean, these women and men who are, you know, with increased life expectancy due to medical inroads, better drugs, better fitness, better diet, better everything, you know, most of us, if we avoid cancer and heart disease and really take care of ourselves, can have a pretty long, good life.
And talking about sex getting better with age, I love your blog post titled The Fine Line Between Marriage and Divorce, where one 77-year-old woman wrote you that her husband of 57 years still brought her Victoria's Secret lingerie. That's great.
I know, it was great. And, you know, and so why should that be surprising? If young people can have sexual adventures, so can older people. And that's very, very enlightening, and we need to embrace that. You know, we need to get rid of the yuck factor in everything. You know, same people of the same sex are partnering and getting married. Grandmothers and great-grandmothers who are widowed are dating again. Unfortunately, STDs have hit senior communities. And so older people and younger people are really grappling with the same kind of struggles, the same kind of challenges, and the same kind of victories in sex and intimacy.
And by the way, doesn't research show that sex can even help us live longer?
Oh, my gosh, completely. Even to hug someone three times a day gets those juices going that are the chemicals that reduce stress. It's all about reduction of stress. If you reduce stress, you're reducing your chances of all those killer diseases. You know, stress-related illness, all of those are probably the number one cause of death other than, you know, breast cancer and other cancers. We can't prove they're stress-related, but we can't prove they're not.
And finally, I want to ask you about your first chapter in which you say that sex matters by saying, you say that a relationship can benefit from sex because it can act as a bridge of intimacy. And what did you mean when you wrote that?
I love that. I love that. I forgot what page that's on. That's like my favorite. That's my favorite three sentences in the book. That's right in the beginning, isn't it?
Right, it is.
You know, it's sexual chemistry gets us going in a relationship. But then you stay in that relationship because of friendship, because of humor, because of, you know, your souls are matched, your minds are matched. For sex to be good, it has to be a mental match. It has to be a match of emotions. It has to be a match of the soul. So you get there by physical attraction, but you don't stay there by physical attraction. And in this book, and I love this book. You know, I don't always say, I loved the journey of writing Sex After, dot, dot, dot. You know, people say, why did you call the book Sex After, dot, dot, dot? And I called it that because sex always comes after something. But I loved the journey because I learned so much. I learned what was possible. I learned what I should do. God forbid my husband's diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it's a tiny little cancer. I learned that active surveillance is better than just getting in there and taking everything out. I learned that breast cancer survivors go on and have great intimate lives. I learned that a young bride whose husband came back from Afghanistan missing a leg has one of the best marriages going. I learned that a couple post-menopause, he has low testosterone, she has no libido, that they have no sex, and they consider themselves intimate, sexually married. So, you know, there's no normal when it comes to sexuality. And if I was to reduce and have a finale with you to be that, don't look over your shoulder and think that you're not measuring up to what, you know, your sister's doing, your friend's doing, your college roommate's doing, because no one knows what's going on in someone else's house other than the
Excellent.
Two people in it.
That's Iris Krasnow in conversation with Carol Marks, and her book is titled Sex After, Women Share How Intimacy Changes as Life Changes, published by Gotham Books. Carol Marks conducted that interview. And I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair here on A Touch of Grey. We'll be joined by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, the rest of the way when A Touch of Grey continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do. And I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and for the rest of the way, we're going to be joined this hour by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer, who just moments from now will be speaking with Scott Stossel. He's the editor of Atlantic Magazine, and he's going to talk about his memoir, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House and Knopf. Is it Knopf, Richard, or is it Knopf?
It's Knopf, I believe.
Yeah, I always forget that, and I have been forgetting that now. I have been on the radio since Marconi, and I still don't get it right. Knopf, yeah, because usually a K is silent. And then
well,
there's the F.
Sometimes
at the end.
It is.
It's PF.
In Knight, it's not.
The Knights of the Round Table.
The Knights.
but Knopf is K-N-O-P-F. I mean, it plays games with your sense of phonics.
PH, right, yeah.
It's PF.
This is why English is such a hard language for people to learn, because the rules change. You know, most languages have very hard and fast grammatical rules that you follow, and you learn them, and that's it. English, well, we do it most of the time this way, but sometimes, on occasion, we do it the other way.
English is one of the hardest languages for somebody who doesn't speak it to learn, although I hear that Arabic and Chinese are the two hardest. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, boy, I'm just flaunting my lack of knowledge today. I saw that as one of those factoids on one of the shows I watch on cable television, and I don't remember what show it was. But it was talking about, it was on, like, maybe the Science Channel. It was one of those anthropological shows, and they were talking about language, and then they you know how they put on the screen, like, a little blurb, and it said that, according to blah, blah, Chinese and Arabic are the two hardest languages to learn. So, yeah.
Well, that's one of those things where they say that dogs see a certain thing, and I say, well, how do they know that? How do you measure how hard a language is? Do you have 100 people in a room and say, okay, here's 10 words of Chinese, memorize them, and they get a lower score than people who remember 10 words of German or something?
I wouldn't be surprised if they do. I really wouldn't. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, there are all kinds of crazy studies going on out there in think tanks, colleges, universities, and research labs. You don't know. Maybe there is. But regardless, it sounds like this is going to be a very interesting conversation. And, I mean, just those words, fear, hope, dread, and the search for peace of mind.
Actually, I'm a little worried it's not going to go well. I'm getting nervous and anxious.
Don't let anxiety get in the way
to help me.
Of you doing a good interview.
Okay, I'll try.
And we will be rejoined by Richard Neer in the final segment after the aforementioned piece of dialogue that is about to ensue. And we will wrap things up. It'll be fun to talk to Richard again at the end of the program. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you're the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best. So take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again, as promised, is our senior correspondent Richard Neer in conversation with Scott Stossel. He's the editor of Atlantic Magazine, and he's going to talk to Richard about his memoir titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House Knopf.
You're not just talking about the anxious feeling that most of us have when we're going to the dentist or something. We're talking about something a lot more serious than just that, correct?
Right. I'm talking about all kinds of anxiety in the book. But, yeah, what you're referring to is and what I talk about in the book at greatest length and what I suffer from myself is clinical anxiety or anxiety disorders. And that's where anxiety, whether it's in the form of phobias like fear of heights or enclosed spaces or flying or public speaking, or social phobia, which is general kind of fear of social interaction, or panic disorder, which is, you know, experiencing these overwhelming panic attacks, you know, becomes so severe that it starts to interfere with your life and really make you miserable. And the latest data, you know, from official sources suggests that, you know, some 1 in 6 American adults suffer from this, and probably similar numbers around the world.
So, Scott, are there people who are just actually anxious at everything, or, like, you delineated a whole bunch of different things that you can be anxious about. Are there people who are just anxious about one or two things, or are there people who are anxious for a whole host of items?
There's both. I mean, if you have what's known as generalized anxiety disorder, you just have a propensity to sort of worry and think about sort of negative consequences for every potential thing you get involved in. And there is a kind of baseline level of, you know, anxious temperament that some people have that just make them inclined to be worried. Many of these people also have specific separate fears and phobias, but there are also people who, you know, are not generally anxious but have one very specific phobia, whether that's flying or fear of heights. I was actually just last night, someone had written out to me, had read the book, and he's a meteorologist in South Carolina, and he was saying, I talk in my book about sort of fears of public speaking, and he says, I have no fear of public speaking. I go on television every night. I talk to people in public events. He says, but if I'm driving alone at night or trying to get on an airplane, I'm an absolute nervous wreck. So there are definitely weird idiosyncratic fears. One of the most interesting ones I came across, the actor Richard Burton, had an intense phobia of honey and literally couldn't be in a room with a jar of honey, even if the jar was closed and even if the jar was locked in a drawer.
I thought you were going to say he had a fear of staying sober, which is another
that issue may have been related.
Another issue entirely. Where did these things come from? Are these things traumatic events early in life? I mean, how can we pinpoint some of the causes of these anxieties?
Well, I sort of explore, you know, there all the manifold theories about what causes anxiety, and I think it's a combination of a bunch of different things. I mean, most fundamentally, I think there is everyone comes with a sort of genetic predisposition to either be, you know, anxious in stressful circumstances or to be not anxious in stressful circumstances. So, you know, you come, you know, almost out of the womb with a certain temperamental predisposition that, you know, gives you a physiology that either reacts with high levels of, you know, stress, or not to. But then on top of that, obviously there, you know, as Freud and many since then have talked about, you know, early childhood experiences and your relationship with your parents and your upbringing can have a powerful effect that can kind of either override or intensify the effects of your genetic heritage. And then, you know, whether you've been exposed to trauma and your level of stress and just kind of what's going on in your life, and then, you know, random luck. I mean, almost everyone has some breaking point. You know, they've done studies of people in the military. You know, some people are supremely resilient to developing PTSD or other forms of anxiety, even under extreme pressure. But most people have some breaking point. It's just that where you fall on that spectrum varies a lot. And some people break down, you know, even before they get to the front. Other people can withstand, you know, multiple horrific things before they crack.
And you describe in great detail your wedding, where your bride is glowing and you're just going crazy here. You're just so anxious. Did you locate the source of that anxiety? I mean, was it fear of the life going forward in a marital situation, or what was going on there with you?
I mean,
you?
It could have been that underlying it, but really it was just, what I think it mostly was, again, my sort of fear of public speaking. And in fact, I wasn't doing a lot of speaking, but just being in front of all of these people, 250 or so of my closest friends and family and colleagues and my wife's friends. And it was legitimately very hot in the church that day, so I started to sweat. And then, if you're prone to anxiety, you start worrying, well, are people noticing that I'm sweating, which makes you more anxious, which makes you sweat more. And then I could see people looking at me from behind the minister, who are, the people we'd sort of assigned to do the readings, and they can see me turning pale and sweaty, and my best man is handing me handkerchiefs to mop my brow, and I'm starting to shake. And suddenly, I'm trying to go through the wedding, and I'm, barely functioning. I'm just, I just have this sort of undercurrent of anxious thoughts running through my mind, which is very typical of, people who suffer from this kind of anxiety. And then, I've talked to people who have read the book who are at the wedding say, we were at your wedding and yeah, you looked really sweaty, but we just assumed it was hot and you were a little bit nervous. Nobody knew you had this horrific, this internal dialogue where it felt like I was about to die.
People will be listening and they'll go, okay, well, I can take something, can't I, to relieve my anxiety? And that doesn't really solve the problem. It may mask the symptom, but it may cause other problems, no?
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of, there are people in disparate camps on medication. And on one side, you have the people who have the view that, just as you say, that, at best, medication can mask the symptoms for some people without at all addressing the underlying problem, in fact keeping you from addressing the underlying problem. And at worst, maybe the drugs are, causing dependency or creating horrible side effects or simply not helping at all. And on the other side, you have another camp, the kind of Dr. Feelgoods, who will, throw pills at anything and keep throwing more pills at you until you're cured. My own view is that, the critics have some are right about something, and we're right to be, both as individuals and as a society, to sort of question our heavy reliance on medication. But as someone who has taken medication more or less continuously and a whole bunch of different ones over 34 years, I can say, it's true that some of them work only some of the time for some people, and they do have dreadful side effects, but they can be enormously effective at mitigating the worst of the symptoms, and that they should be an important part of the psychotherapeutic arsenal, and the mental health field should not be afraid of using them carefully, but people also should be prudent about becoming dependent on them. And the jury is still out in the long run about whether as a society it's good that we're all so heavily medicated for anxiety and depression, but they can help some people some of the time, so I'm not anti-medication at all.
Well, the book deals with many things in deep detail, and obviously in a radio interview, we don't have time to get into all of them. But give us, for example, meeting new people. A lot of people have anxiety over that, maybe not to the extent that they flop sweat and some of the symptoms you exhibited at your wedding. But how do we overcome some of those anxieties about meeting new people, which is something that happens to all of us every day?
Yeah, well, actually, there are some people who do experience it as acutely as I did during my wedding, where they can't date, they can't work in a workplace. They're so afraid. I mean, I've come across stories in the clinical literature of there was a woman who was going to be honored at a dinner, and she couldn't bear the thought of all that attention on her, so she pled ill. And then they rescheduled the dinner for just a smaller group, and even that smaller gathering was so terrifying to her that she quit her job rather than do that. This was for a positive thing. So there are some people whose lives are completely constrained by this. So, one of the most effective treatments for all forms of anxiety these days, and also for things like depression and insomnia, is something called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is basically kind of a concentrated form of talk therapy that's focused, with anxiety, it's specifically on exposing yourself to the thing that you fear the most and learning to, you experience the anxiety and then learn that you can cope with it, and then working with a therapist to retrain your thought pattern so you don't have such negative kind of running dialogue in your head, like people with those acute social phobia, and they're meeting people, they're saying, oh, they don't like me, or they think I'm ugly, or I just said something stupid, and they kind of get in their own way. And so this is sort of retraining your thought patterns to not have those thoughts, and just practice. I mean, as with all specific phobias, exposure to the thing that you are afraid of and doing it again and again is the best way to reduce the anxiety. Now, it's easier said than done. As I say, as somebody with acute phobias myself, there's nothing more terrifying than being exposed to the thing you're terrified of. But that is often the prescribed remedy.
That's Scott Stossel in conversation with Richard Neer. He is the author of the book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Random House Knopf. Richard Neer returns in just a few minutes, and we will conclude this two-hour installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair as we head into the final segment of our two-hour broadcast, and we are joined again by our senior correspondent, Richard Neer. Certainly was an interesting conversation that you had with the guest talking about dread and anxiety and all of that stuff, Scott Stossel, and I hope that you've overcome your anxiety, Richard, and that now you're ready to talk about something that is fun, something that has no controversy attached to it whatsoever, something that people just love to talk about and relax, and that's baseball. Nothing really to talk about in that regard, no controversy, correct?
Well, there is a bit of a controversy that started in New York and went nationwide, and as all great sports stories, they are one of these things that are universally applicable, not just sports. In that Daniel Murphy, the Mets' second baseman, spent 2 days with his wife upon the birth of their first child. And a couple of radio broadcasters, whose name shall go unmentioned by me anyway, went on the air and said that one of them suggested that his wife should have had a C-section prior to the start of the season so that he could have made it for opening day. Another one agreed that he had no right to take these days off, that he should have been there with his teammates instead of with his wife after one day.
And then a third one, there were three talk show hosts, sports talk show hosts, and then one just said, you know, he really doesn't understand why a baseball player would take a day off or take more time off. After all, he didn't take many days off for the birth of his child. He sort of took a moderate approach, but it was
I mean, back in the day, I mean, when you and I were born, I don't know about your parents, but my father wasn't present. He was in the waiting room.
No, that was before natural childbirth became a vogue, and they taught fathers to be part of the process. And a childbirth, when I was a kid, I remember very well, was sort of looked at as surgery. You would no more go into childbirth as the father than you would join your wife if she was having her appendix removed or a hernia fixed or open heart surgery. It was considered surgery then.
But things have changed to where, you know, you go to classes together, Lamaze classes together, and you're expected to be there and count and help the breathing and hold the hand and do all the things that you're in it together.
Okay, so where do we stand on this? I can't tell whether we're talking about it. Are we falling over to the line like, we should go back to the old days when men were men and they didn't have to be involved in that?
It was collectively bargained as part of the contract that the players signed with the owners in 2011 that they get up to 3 days of maternity or paternity leave when a child is born.
Well, okay.
So they have a perfect right to do it, but the Mets being so bad this year could ill afford missing anybody, much less Daniel Murphy. So these rabid sports hosts were, oh, man, he should be there, and, you know, not considering that, you know, maybe his wife might want his presence.
Okay, okay, there's a few things going on here, and time is running out, unfortunately. That my first statement was, where do you and I stand on the idea that men are part of the process? Are we for it or against it?
If they want to be in, their wife wants them to be, they should be. If they don't, you know, some women probably don't want their husbands to be there. Some do.
Okay, so it should be up to the couple.
It's a private matter.
Okay. All right. I'll leave it at that. I kind of think it's a good idea. Now, the other thing I want to ask you, we only have a minute. This is not good because this is a fascinating topic. Isn't there in the regular law, isn't it more than 3 days that a person could take up to 2 weeks, I believe, on paternity leave? I'm not sure if baseball has a special clause or something because it's baseball. Do you know anything about that?
I'm not sure if it's federal or state. Maybe states are different. But baseball does specify 3 days in their collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, it was a good conversation, and what comes out of it is the proof that sports talk can transcend sports, and all good talk, I believe, should transcend whatever it's born at is. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Hardly enough time to deal with that topic, but, you know, you get the gist of it, folks. Plus, you've heard it talked about elsewhere. Thank you, Beverly Santinello, on the front line. Thank you, Richard Neer. Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Thank you, Kevin Casey. Thanks to the entire Touch of Gray broadcast team. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend. Join Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, in another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.